Fancy a game?
Tyler Bischoff is...
And are they both trying not to laugh at the word duty?
Yeah.
Technically correct.
Why is she speaking
Because they learned English from Professor Magoo over there.
Relax, we'll be in and out. Anyway, you've never seen my lab.
Oh, great. I get to see your nerd lab.
Hello, dying to save the stock market. We will have the new Lady Rebel coach, Lindy LaRocque, joining us. We have a ton of Raiders and NFL offseason to get into. We're also going to take a look back at UNLV and Ball State from 1990. Thanks to everybody who tuned in last night to watch that with me. But we start with the Raiders. And are you ready to get excited about the Raiders defense? I've got some optimism for you here, because we are looking at Corey Littleton and the Raiders linebackers. And Pro Football Focus wrote a story on the Raiders linebackers and Corey Littleton. So first off, last season for the Raiders, as a team, they ranked 29th in pass coverage by Pro Football Focus in the NFL. The linebackers specifically were the second worst pass coverage unit in all of the NFL last year. Essentially, the Raiders linebackers could not cover anyone last season. So they bring in Corey Littleton. And from Pro Football Focus, they wrote this. During his four seasons with the LA Rams, Littleton logged close to 1,200 coverage snaps, earning a Pro Football Focus coverage grade of 87.3, second among all linebackers. So over the last 4 years, Corey Littleton has been one of the best coverage linebackers in the NFL, and he is now a Raider. What I found to be interesting, though, was the way Pro Football Focus described Littleton's ideal usage with the Rams. He was at his best essentially in their dime package, when they would put him in and he would be the only linebacker with six defensive backs on the field in obvious passing situations. Now, I don't think the Raiders have six defensive backs that they want on the field, so I don't know how much they'll be playing that, but Littleton does fix the biggest hole this team had last season. The linebackers couldn't cover anybody. Like, it was a bad defense overall, but the number one problem was the linebackers were so bad, and it's in a division against the Chiefs and Patrick Mahomes where you might want to be in a dime the entire time you played Chiefs and Patrick Mahomes, and you need a linebacker that can at least slow down Travis Kelce. Right, I don't think there's any expectation that Corey Littleton's going to come in and in the two meetings with the Chiefs, Travis Kelce's going to have like two catches and 24 yards, right? But if you can come in and keep Travis Kelce to where he's not a massive threat on every single play because, oh, Tahir Whitehead slipped again, then you've got a much better shot to actually pull off that upset. One of our criticisms last year of the roster was that they built the defense primarily to stop the run, right? Whether it was players they drafted like Cleland Furl, right? He's a run-stopping defensive end. Woo! Or Jonathan Abram, who actually ended up playing, but as a hard-hitting safety that's good against the run. Or, you know, some of the free agents they brought in, like Avantez Perfect, and there were guys already on the roster. Carl Joseph is another hitting free safety that should be good against the run. Last season's roster was mostly a bunch of players that were better against the run than they were against the pass. Littleton is the exact opposite of that. His weakness is stopping the run, but he excels in pass coverage. So Corey Littleton coming in, excellent move by the Raiders. Like, it's. I don't think there could have been a better fit for a player that was available for the Raiders to go get for what they had as their biggest problem last year. But now, the biggest problem for this team is going to be in the secondary. That's still going to be a huge issue, because I'm guessing the Raiders are going to try and play Littleton and Nick Kwiatkowski together as much as possible. Right, I don't think they're going to want to go to a dime defense that often, because I think they're going to want, A, those two on the field because they're good, and B, they don't actually have six good defensive backs, so probably more of a 4-2-5 for the most part with the Raiders. But even if you're trying to figure out those five defensive backs that are on the field, I don't know that you have five good defensive backs if you're the Raiders, because if you go through it right now, the starting cornerbacks for the Raiders would be Trayvon Mullen and Eli Apple. We have the expectation that they will draft a cornerback in the first round and that he could take the starting job away from Eli Apple. But two of those three will be your starting cornerbacks: Eli Apple, Trayvon Mullen, and a rookie. So you're looking at a second-year player who played half of a season last year after being a second-round pick, a rookie probably taken in the first round, or their fourth choice in the offseason at cornerback through free agency and trades. Those are your potential starting cornerbacks. The slot corner is expected to be LaMarcus Joyner. He was terrible in that role last season, right? A big reason why their pass defense struggled, aside from the linebackers, was LaMarcus Joyner did not live up to the expectations of being a good slot corner. Gruden apparently has plans to try him out at slot corner again, so they're going with LaMarcus Joyner, even though he wasn't that good last season. And then at the two safety spots, Jonathan Abrams expected to start, essentially another rookie. He got hurt in week one last year and didn't play at all. The other safety spot, you're looking at Eric Harris, maybe, who was probably their best defensive back before Trayvon Mullen came on last season, and Jeff Heath, the guy they signed from the Cowboys. Both you're better off if they are depth options at safety rather than your starting safety. So none of those are really like, nothing they have in the secondary you can point to and say, that guy is a great NFL player and he's going to be good all season. They do not have that in the secondary. You think Trayvon Mullen can get there because he had a good second half of the year last year. You think Jonathan Abram can get there. He's a first round pick last season, right? Maybe they draft another corner in the first round and you're going to think that guy can be a good corner as well, right? So there's some guys that could be there, but you look at the secondary and it's kind of terrifying.
Why weren't they in on Quentin Dunbar? Like, the Seahawks give up a fifth round pick for a starting corner.
Maybe they didn't know.
I mean, I guess they did. Maybe. Oh, yeah. The Washington football team fired Gruden's brother, so maybe he's just like, no, when they call.
Possibly. I mean, they were in on, like, every other cornerback. So
yeah.
Maybe they were, and I don't know, but they were in
they
on pretty
were there
much
like,
in.
We're hard on a sixth.
When did Dunbar get traded?
Yesterday.
Okay, I was going to say, that was recent. All right, I don't know. Maybe, how much does Dunbar get paid? Because they don't have very much salary cap space.
I believe
space
he's an undrafted free agent. So is he?
Okay. So pretty cheap. All right. Because yeah. They are very low on cap space at the moment, so they can't really make any
oh,
more
they just
big
traded.
Moves.
I found out where Kyle Allen is. The Washington football team traded for him. All right. I've been wondering what happened to Kyle Allen for the longest time.
So it's Kyle Allen and Dwayne Haskins?
Murderer's Row.
They don't have another quarterback over there? Case.
Alex Smith is still technically
oh,
on that
run. That's who it is. All right.
He just has an infection in his leg, and their doctors are puzzled.
I see. Puzzled. That's a terrifying thing if you got an infection in your leg. Yeah,
well, they had a really good right tackle. He got an infection in his shoulder, and the doctors kept going, no, let us get back in there. And he went, you didn't do it right the first time.
Back on the Raiders defense, though. Wait, what do you got?
Oh, I just wanted to point out that basically all of these free agent signings for the Raiders, if you just went by Madden rankings, like I know you want to go with analytics, but Madden rankings are based off of Pro Football Focus. These are a bunch of mid-70s dudes.
What's Littleton?
Littleton is a 80.
Okay. So he's the best, I assume.
Yes, and then, but it's a bunch of like 74s.
All right.
Which
what was their defense last year? 68s?
Yeah. So this is the most lackluster. We're getting to average.
Yeah. So, okay. If you look at the position groups, right, I think, you know, you take Littleton and Kwiatkowski as the Raiders linebackers. They're probably going to be around a league average linebacker group with those two, assuming neither one of them gets hurt. But if you get full 16 games out of those two, you're probably an average linebacking group in the NFL. Max Crosby, Malik Collins on the interior, Cleland Furl is another starting defensive end with maybe they draft somebody else, but the guys they had last year had some decent plays every now and then. They're probably going to be somewhere in that 15 to 20 range as far as defensive lines go. Like, they're not a terrible defensive line, but they're certainly not a top 10 defensive line. So linebacker, the front seven is going to sort of be an average front seven in the NFL. The problem is the secondary, they could be the worst secondary in football.
Like,
right?
Like Jeff Heath is a 74.
Like, and he might be the best. Like, you're counting on Jeff Heath to be good or something. You're counting on Jeff Heath.
He hasn't done it yet.
Or Eli Apple or LaMarcus Joyner, right? You're counting on those guys to have breakout seasons when we've seen them play in the NFL for the past couple of years, and they haven't really had breakout seasons before. Or you're counting on Trayvon Mullen, Jonathan Abram, and whoever they draft in the first round to play corner to have massive seasons. So it's... that's going to be the biggest weakness on this team. And again, free agency is not over. They could still make a trade for somebody. You know, if Dunbar's out there just starting corner available, maybe there's somebody else that gets traded. you draft one in the first round, maybe you get a great corner in the first round. Like, there's still guys that can be added to this roster that make it better, but it's still, that's going to be the weakness of this team. And if you're trying to find other places on the defense that, you know, make up for it, they're not really good enough at other places. Like, Max Crosby is good, but he's not like, oh, you don't have to have a great secondary because Max Crosby is disrupting every pass. He's good, but he's not that good. And same with Corey Littleton. He's good, but he's not going to be like, oh, we cover up all these other holes. So the secondary is going to be a big problem because, again, you're going to have to play Pat Mahomes twice this year. And that's probably going to hurt you quite a bit when you've got your best coverage guy is, oh, the linebacker we got from the Rams.
And he's going to have to go cover Travis Kelce.
Yeah.
Quick question. Have you heard anything about what they're going to do with Carl Nassib? Like, is he going to be a stand-up outside edge rusher? Is he going to play a traditional defensive end?
Who wrote it? I think it was Vic Tafer wrote about Carl Nassib that the plan for him is essentially the third defensive end, that they're going to start
Crosby. He's going to be a rotational hand in the...
Yeah, yeah. Okay. They're going to start Crosby and Furl, and they're going to use him similar to how they used Benson Mayoa last year.
Okay.
Where Benson Mayoa was the third defensive end. Benson Mayoa in the first like five game or like three games had like five sacks, and they're like, eh, we don't need to play you very much anymore. So that's sort of his role. That being said, they haven't announced what his contract was. Like, we don't know Nassib's contract yet, but it could be one of the bigger ones they signed. So maybe there is a bigger role for him. Maybe he's got a legitimate shot. Do you have it?
I have it from an aggregation. This is actually NBC Sports. It's not Pro Football Talk. Hold on. 3 years, $25 million, $17 million guaranteed.
For Nassib? Really?
Yeah.
All right. I hadn't seen that. That's actually fairly large.
Yeah.
So maybe he's got a shot to unseat Cleveland Furl, right? Like, maybe it's going to be more of I don't know if he's going to be the starter, quote unquote, but, you know, last year they got into specific situations and Cleveland Furl either wasn't on the field for most third downs or was moved to the inside for most third downs. So he'll have a role. Like, he'll be the second or third defensive end.
Nick O'Leary and Eric Kush, their contract terms are currently unknown.
You got to hide those
except
ones.
Except that we do know there will be no signing bonus.
All right. Well, I want to get into the signing bonus stuff, but I got way too much to say about it for the rest of this segment.
Do you want to do it in the no?
What, do you think any news is going to happen? We'll just do it tomorrow.
Okay.
Technically correct. Brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
Check out the podcast on lvsportsnetwork.com. Bischoff's Briefs.
I went on the internet this week.
Oh, God.
And I found this.
Bischoff's Briefs.
There's a lot of porn piling up on the internet. It doesn't download itself.
Bischoff's Briefs.
I think I get it. I think I get it.
Marcus Mariota signed with the Raiders for $17.5 million over 2 years.
Mike Garofolo reported this contract. It's a very complicated contract, but essentially, Marcus Mariota has a one-year deal for $7.5 million guaranteed. And then he can earn as much as $37 million over 2 years based on incentives if he becomes the starter. So the biggest one to pay attention to for this season is he gets a bonus if he takes 60% of the snaps on offense this year. So essentially, that's kind of what Ryan Tannehill did last year. I think Tannehill took over in week 6 or 7. So it was more than half the year is basically 60% of the snaps. So Marcus Mariota's contract is, so again, the only thing that's guaranteed is 1 year, $7.5 million. So if Derek Carr is the starting quarterback this year and nothing changes throughout the course of the year, the Raiders are paying their backup $7.5 million, which is a lot for a backup. Like, it's not a ton, but he would have been the highest paid backup in the NFL if that had been the contract last year, right? $7.5 million would have been the highest paid backup. I think right now it's the 25th highest cap hit among quarterbacks. So it's a high paying backup job. But if Marcus Mariota becomes the starting quarterback, he's going to get paid a lot more. And this is a great deal for Mariota, and it's a pretty good deal for the Raiders because the Raiders essentially have a number two quarterback that could conceivably take the job. If he doesn't, it's not very much of a pain for them to get rid of him or even keep him for next year. I think it's a $10 million salary next season if they keep him around without any of the incentives. So what this does is it gives Marcus Mariota basically, he's basically betting on himself that he can beat Derek Carr. That's what Marcus Mariota is doing here. He's essentially saying, all right, I will take a, you know, quote unquote backup job and backup salary, but my contract is going to be designed so that if I do take the job, I'm essentially making starting quarterback money. And that's, if you're Derek Carr, you got to be a little bit worried about that, because the Raiders at least view this too as, hey, this guy takes the job, he's going to be our starting quarterback and we're going to pay him accordingly. And then what does that mean for Derek Carr?
Sorry, I just am looking at Chase Daniels, all of his. Every time he became a backup, I would go look at his contract and go, $9 million, huh? For him to back somebody up?
Great career.
That guy must be really firm with that clipboard.
Great career.
He just signed a three-year, $13 million contract.
There you go.
To be the backup in Detroit.
That's right. So I am...
That guy must be great.
So the Mariota contract is good. The only real problem for the Raiders is if Mariota does, in fact, take the job from Derek Carr, because then you've got Mariota, who could be making, what would that end up being, $16, $17 million this season or whatever it ends up being, and you're paying Carr $21.5 million, right? Then you've got essentially two low-end starting quarterback contracts, and you don't really need both of those. So that would be a problem next offseason, because if Mariota were to take the job, then you've got to get rid of Carr, and everybody knows you got to get rid of Carr. Nobody's going to really want Derek Carr, so you ultimately end up releasing him at that point.
Or what you do is, if by week two you're 100% like, all right, we're going with Mariota, you basically go, and Derek Carr is a healthy scratch, whenever your guys' quarterbacks get hurt, we should be your number one call.
That could work, yeah, in season. Get rid of him. So I like the Mariota deal. It could potentially be bad for the Raiders, just money-wise and how much they put into the quarterback spot if Mariota takes the job. But if you're Marcus Mariota, it's great. You basically have you're getting $7.5 million, and you've basically got another $30 million bet that you're going to be better than Derek Carr.
It's also really good. Like, I love it for the Raiders because you have a stopgap now.
Yeah.
So if you get rid of Derek Carr, you got a guy on what? You said $17 million and then an additional $15 million. That's fine. Draft Jalen Hurts. Have him sit back there.
Yeah, like you could conceivably do that. It would work. I mean, it would probably make more sense for next year's draft. Like if Mariota were to take the job from Carr this season and then you release Carr and then you've got Mariota for another year under contract, it might make more sense to draft somebody next year. And then you've got Mariota for 1 year if you need him, or play the guy you drafted. So yeah, it's all the quarterback situation right now is a stopgap. At some point in the next 3 years, they're going to draft a quarterback or trade or sign a really good quarterback that they think is going to be the franchise.
Is there an 18-year-old somewhere in this country that in 4 years after this many stopgaps will be the Raiders starting quarterback?
Kenyon Oblad.
The NHL is cutting salaries of league office employees by 25%.
Emily Kaplan of ESPN reporting that apparently their hope is to reduce salaries across the board instead of laying people off. Not to go slippery slope on you with this argument, but that's essentially what the whole coronavirus pandemic has caused. Cutting salaries of 25% is step one. Eventually, I think they'll get to the point where they lay people off, because that's already happening in other industries across the world. It just feels like a matter of time before sports leagues get there too, assuming they don't actually get back in play in July or something like that. If they can have a plan in place to come back in July, then they'll probably be fine. But if we get past June and July and there's no real plan in place as to when these leagues come back, that's when it gets bad. Should I be surprised, though, that businesses don't like have enough money to survive for a few months?
No. I mean, basically, all the advice that financial gurus give individuals, like you need $1,000 saved up, even though that is ridiculous, like I wouldn't be able to afford food. Businesses don't have to operate like that. Businesses, if they get in trouble, you just call up the Congress and they write you a blank check. And then all of a sudden it's like, hey, Ford's doing really well. Bill Foley says he doesn't see how the NHL can finish the regular season.
This was to Fox 5. Bill Foley said, I don't think we're going to have the time frame to finish a regular season. I just don't see how it's going to happen with the timing of the virus. So regular season, not necessarily the playoffs or the entirety of the season. But I'm curious, NBA and NHL sort of have the same decision. What's more important, to have a champion in the 2020 season or to have a full non-interrupted 2020-2021 season that starts on time and is normal, right? Like, I think that's it. If assuming we're able to get through this over the next couple of months, that's going to be the decision both of these leagues face is, do you want to have, you might have a shortened season next year, but you can name a champion this year. Or do you just want to scrap the rest of this season and just start new next year at a normal time frame? I want to see a champion, right? Like, I'd much rather prefer see a champion, even if it's in September and then next year starts late or has a shortened season or something like that. I know the NBA is likely to consider, like, hey, we might completely change our calendar, right? The NBA might take this because there's been, I think it was the Hawks a couple of years ago, proposed the idea of, let's start the season on Christmas Day because that's already a big NBA day, but like, let's not fight football, right? As little as we can fight the NFL, let's not fight the NFL and let's have our calendar essentially go from Christmas until right up until the NFL season starts. So you'd go Christmas until late July or August for the NBA season, which would be fantastic for the sports calendar, right? Because you take, I mean, mid-June to late August is essentially all you've got is Major League Baseball, preseason football, and Major League Soccer, right? You give me NBA playoffs in that time frame instead? Excellent.
I mean, there's also the factor of, and this is something I've wanted forever, you draft a guy in the same season that he may get to play.
Oh, that would be weird. So that's Major League Baseball does that.
Yes, they're the only league that does that. I want, he was really good in summer league. Let's bring him on up for the playoffs, see if he can't do anything.
So it wouldn't even be that. It would be March Madness ends.
Oh, yeah. These kids would be exhausted.
First weekend of April, March Madness ends. You hold the draft, and those guys are in the playoffs for you.
Yep.
So that's your first season. Your rookie of the year is who plays the best in the playoffs.
Just whoever looks the most exhausted. Like, I already took Marquette to a Sweet 16. Can't I get a break? The Raiders signed Nelson Agholor for $1.05 million.
Absolutely nothing. Nothing at all for Nelson Agholor. And so on the signing bonuses.
This is a kick the tires.
So he's actually the only Raider that got a signing bonus this offseason because he signed for the minimum salary of $910,000. The rest of his contract is a signing bonus. So he got like $140,000 signing bonus. Even Mark Davis can afford that. But according to NBC Sports, the reason for that is if you sign a veteran to a minimum salary, his full deal does not count against the salary cap. So you sign with the minimum salary, give him a little bit more in a signing bonus, and it helps you save some cap space. It's probably not that much because ultimately he's only making $1.05 million, but it is a little bit for Nelson Agholor. But is he even going to make the team?
Has he done any returns? I was trying to find this out a little bit ago, and has he ever returned a kick?
So Josh Dubow of the AP actually tweeted about this yesterday. I believe he's got four returns in his NFL career. But in college, he was in a return man. He returned a lot in college. So, yeah, that could be a role for him where he's like the fourth or fifth wide receiver, but his primary duty is to be the kick and punt returner.
They had a really good returner that they traded to, I want to say, the Vikings?
Cordell Patterson?
No, this was... Hopkins? No. All right. I'll have to Google it during the break.
Okay. All right. But so, yeah, you're right. Maybe he does make it as a punt and kick returner in the fifth wide receiver, but it's not that much money. He might not make it at all. Keelan Doss might beat him out. All right. Coming up next, we talk to Lindy LaRock, the new head coach of the Lady Rebels.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff,
First place. We stole the first place trophy out of Herbie's van.
Joining us now is the new head coach of the Lady Rebels, Lindy LaRocque. She comes over from Stanford, where she played her career and then was an assistant coach over the last few years. Lindy, how are you this morning?
I am great. How are you? Thank you for having me on.
Yes, we are glad to have you on the show. I'm curious, what was the interview process like for this job, given that we're in the middle of the coronavirus outbreak?
What I can say is that Desiree and her search committee were fair and professional. We kind of got started before a lot of this corona stuff really came to fruition. So I was happy to kind of get started before then. But as far as kind of the details of it, I was happy to get to know everyone, and I'm excited for the future. And, you know, it's going to be an exciting time in Las Vegas for the Lady Rebels.
So it was a fairly normal actual interviewing process. There wasn't like a whole bunch of Skype meetings and trying to get your internet to work for that.
No, I guess not. I will be honest and haven't been through a ton of different interviews to be able to compare, but as far as kind of how working day to day is, that's just kind of what our situation is in the world right now.
What was it like for you guys at Stanford having the season end before you got a chance to even play in the NCAA tournament?
Honestly, it was pretty surreal. Obviously it's, you feel for the team, the players, the seniors, especially even for us staff members, you know, that kind of work so hard all year. And in a lot of ways, the NCAA tournament is the culmination of where you get to, show your best self. And so, obviously we were disappointed and kind of more just sad that it kind of had to end that way. But obviously it was the right thing to do and still is the right thing to do. So I think, if anything, it gives you a perspective on the bigger picture and, what's really important in life. And obviously we love sports and we love basketball, but, health and safety are number one. So
I know the NCAA, they're not going to do this for basketball. I think they're still considering it potentially for some of the spring sports. But in the coaching spot, how difficult would it have been to navigate if there had been an extra year of eligibility given to players who missed out on playing in the NCAA tournament this year?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that would be a big challenge, I think, for the NCAA to tackle because obviously we would take from their lead. But, besides just allowing, some student athletes another year, that would affect a lot, kind of have a trickle-down effect on a lot of different rules. Have a department effect on each university as far as scholarship number and financial aid. And, it's not just like, I think give these student athletes an extra year and it'll all be, fixed. I think they, if they go that route and, I know I kind of, it sounds like they will do that for the spring sports, but even then I think they still have lots to tackle to kind of help fix or make that situation the best possibility for all of the universities and institutions.
So Lindy LaRocque with us, the new head coach of the Lady Rebels. What's it mean to you to come back to Las Vegas and be a head coach at UNLV?
It's amazing. Obviously, the Las Vegas community is a community that raised and shaped me. I love it. I love the people there. I have family still there. My high school, middle school, there's lots of family support and kind of the outpouring love and support from the community just since this has all taken place has really just been tremendous and special. So, it's such a unique situation. And I think just helped make this already extremely attractive and amazing opportunity that more special to me personally because of, my ties to the city.
It was in the Review Journal, but I read that I think it was in ninth grade you played AAU for a boys team because there wasn't AAU for girls then?
Yes, that's true. that was kind of really before the whole club basketball scene, you know, exploded.
And how was that?
It was great. It was great. You know, as a young girl wanting to be super competitive and challenge myself, the boys team, you know, welcomed me with open arms and treated me like one of the guys and didn't take it easy on me. And, you know, I think I still have some great friends from that team still to this day. And the coaches were awesome. And so I loved that experience and think it helped me, obviously, in my playing career and now coaching.
So your father coached basketball, you play growing up, play in college, you're coaching now. Was there ever a point, though, along the way where you thought, I don't want to, or I'm not going to be playing or coaching in basketball?
No. No. From a very young age, you know, actually, I think it comes back to, obviously, my father is a coach, but really, I come from a family of educators. My mother is a teacher. My father was a coach, but he was a teacher first. My grandparents are teachers, my aunts, my uncles. You know, my cousins are teachers. So I think really it's the teaching, the educating that, you know, I knew from an early age that I wanted to do. That's what I was around. And so kind of adding the basketball into it, I just think it's another form of teaching in a different classroom, if you will. So even, you know, growing up, I wanted to be a teacher and a basketball coach because I think they go very hand in hand.
So did you sort of have that mindset when you were playing at Stanford of, hey, I want to be in the coach's shoes one day?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, that was part of my decision in choosing to go to Stanford. You know, Coach Vanderveer is, if not, you know, the best, one of the very best basketball coaches, male or female, ever. And she will always be that. And so knowing as a player that I could learn from her, that I could, you know, obviously be in practice every day and help shape my, you know, coaching mind, that was something, you know, that was always in the forefront of my mind as a player and then kind of transitioning to coaching. You know, she's been very special and instrumental to me. And, you know, and I owe a lot to her.
You've been a part of a lot of different teams that have been to the NCAA tournament. You're taking over a program that hasn't been since 2002. So aside from, like, good players, like, what do teams need to make the NCAA tournament?
Obviously, the players, you know, play an important piece. But, you know, I think for us and the Lady Rebels this year and moving forward, obviously, we will have a goal of getting to that NCAA tournament, but that won't be talked about every day. You know, our everyday goal is going to be to get better. And I think if we can focus on that process and focus on getting a little bit better each day, then the improvement will happen. The results will happen. The success will come because of the hard work and the time that we put in. So, you know, I would love to take this team, you know, to the NCAA tournament, and I plan to, and we want to, and I know that's what those young ladies came to UNLV to do. So we're going to work our hardest to do that, and it's going to start, you know, day one, and then the next day, and then the next day, and not get too, you know, we're not going to look forward too far. We're going to focus on the here and now and how we can get better.
Coach, I ask this question to literally every new UNLV coach. Famously, Chauncey Billups used to egg the refs on to get Rasheed Wallace teed up because it's what made him focus on the game. What is the weirdest thing you've had to do to get a player's head in the game?
Oh, that is a unique question for sure. You know, I think part of coaching is finding, you know, and adapting and coaching each player differently. You know, so as I get to know these young ladies, you know, I'm going to find out what motivates them, how they want to be coached, and then adapt my coaching style to help get the best out of each individual player and help them be the best version of themselves. So I don't know if I have a good, witty answer for you, you know, or a great story off the top of my head. But, you know, sometimes I think actually I get the best response from some of the players that I've coached by giving them something to laugh about, to kind of take their mind away from whatever is, you know, stressing them, and then in the current situation, give them something to laugh about, give them something to think about that they love, and then more often than not, they go out and they perform well.
So we had Tim Buckley, one of the assistants on for the men's team, on earlier this season, and he sort of gave an exact opposite setup for the story. I can't, Jared, do you remember who the head coach was? He was just an assistant. I can't remember who the head coach was or where he was, but he said the head coach at the time, they were playing like on a Monday or Tuesday before Thanksgiving, and like 4 minutes in, they were playing terribly, and the head coach during the first media timeout essentially told him, if you guys don't get it together, you're not going home with your parents for Thanksgiving. You guys are staying here, and that they came back and ended up winning the game.
Wow.
So withhold food.
Yes, the key is to take away their holidays, is all Jared wants you to know.
Yeah.
I'm curious, would you describe yourself as a coach that's the exact opposite or very similar to how your father coached?
Oh, well, it's been a few years since my father was actually out on the court there coaching. I think actually his last year was my senior year. But from what I remember, I would say we're pretty similar, or I hope that we are. I think, you know, some of my passion and my emotion in the game, you know, is a strong suit. But then I also try to keep a very stoic, mild-mannered demeanor, you know, to help, you know, the players kind of stay calm themselves. So, you know, we'll see. That'll maybe be for you guys to judge after this first season.
Well, so what should we set the over-under for technical fouls next year on? One or two?
Oh, I hope not to get any.
we want you to get as many as possible. Or whatever, just below getting fined.
No, we don't need any of that. We don't need it. We love good, clean basketball, and hopefully we just score a lot of points, and then, you know, you don't have to put yourself in a situation to do that.
There you go. Well, she is Lindy LaRocque. She is the new head coach of the Lady Rebels. Lindy, we appreciate your time.
Thank you guys so much. I look forward to speaking with you more in the future.
Yes. Thanks, Coach.
Thank you. So there you go. She doesn't want any technical fouls. Did TJ Altsberg get one this year?
Yes, and apparently it was on something that was definitely not worth it.
Yeah, probably not, but I think he only got one.
Back to what we were talking about with the Raiders return specialist thing, I got none of the details right.
It was
a Packers player traded to the Raiders who was a return specialist named Trevor Davis. None of the details
awesome.
Right.
Awesome. So it wasn't Harris or Harrison or Haskins like you thought it was.
Oh, no. Dwayne Harris is the like really good return specialist. He's still a Raider. He's just hurt.
That's right. They did add Trevor Davis in the middle of the year.
Yeah, and he was promptly cut.
All right. Good job, Jared. Good work. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about UNLV Ball State from 1990 in the Sweet 16.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler.
Hey, it's Tyler Bischoff. The best spot to place your bets is the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook. But if you're looking for even more convenience, download the Be Connected Sports app from BeConnectedSports.com. The Be Connected Sports app makes it easy to place bets from your phone or tablet and allows you to bet during the game. So download the Be Connected Sports app, and you can be just a few clicks away from betting on the biggest games whenever you want. Boyd Gaming has you covered at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook or at BeConnectedSports.com.
It's the Press Box on ESPN 1100 and 100.9 FM.
One, two, three, four, uno, dos, tres, I know you want me.
This is not the Press Box. We haven't acknowledged it yet, but Jared filling in on the Press Box this morning, so I guess that's where the blame goes.
I may have played a technically correct rejoin for Mike Grimala, and then he decided to do the entire interview by calling Ed Graney Tyler. And so the exchange was, in order to make up for that mistake, I apparently need to make more mistakes.
That's so, okay. That's a fair trade-off.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that.
I would now like to get Mike Grimala on the phone sometime this week so that he can call you Clay the entire time.
Tomorrow. Mike Grimala will join us tomorrow. Ooh. Not Mike Grimala.
Do I
Mike
need
Grimala.
To go get a hot plate and some, like, masks for us?
He's not coming in, no.
Oh, I thought he was grilling for us.
That's, like, against the law.
I know. Can't have hot plates inside buildings.
Unbelievable. One note, which we'll probably get into more tomorrow, but according to Mark Anderson, UNLV is expected to hire Glenn Thomas as their quarterback's coach. Remember, they lost Danny Langsdorf, what was that, last month? Mm-hmm. But UNLV has gone and poached a coach because Glenn Thomas was at Baylor last season, but he took a job earlier this offseason to go to Temple as an analyst. So he was at Temple for like 2 months, and UNLV goes and poaches him, and he'll now be the quarterback's coach at UNLV. So we'll see if there's anything interesting on Glenn Thomas. I might get into that more tomorrow. But thank you to everybody who watched last night. We streamed UNLV and Ball State, the Sweet 16 matchup from 1990, on Twitter and Periscope last night. We're doing it again tomorrow for the Elite Eight game against Loyola Marymount. But first off, UNLV extremely lucky to win that game. They scored approximately 10 points over the last 12 minutes. I should say 10 points over approximately the last 12 minutes. But UNLV almost lost that game simply by missing free throws. In the final 30 seconds, they were 1 of 5 on free throws.
That's not that many.
And ended up winning by 2. And the reason it wasn't that many is because back then, apparently, if you got fouled while not shooting, it was always 1 and 1. Well, once you got to the bonus, it was always 1 and 1. Right, there were no two-shot fouls for fouling a guy while dribbling. UNLV missed the front end of a 1 and 1 3 times in the final 30 seconds.
I actually don't hate that rule. Can we bring it back?
I kind of like it, too. And it made that game more entertaining because UNLV would have hit a couple of those other free throws if they had been two-shot fouls. So UNLV, it was 1 for 5. It could have been like 1 for 8 had they gotten to shoot 2 free throws and missed all of those as well. But they also got lucky because there was just a random intentional foul called on Ball State. So UNLV, with like 15 seconds left, UNLV gets 2 free throws. They only made 1 of them, then got to take the ball out again and got fouled again. Now they missed the front end of the 1 and 1, so they didn't actually get extra points out of it, but killed some time off the clock. And then Ball State had the worst final possession you'll ever see in your life. It was terrible. You guys think Menzies and Dave Rice and Otzelberger don't draw plays. Good Lord, what was Ball State doing on that final play? But big picture for UNLV in that year, did they have the easiest run anybody's ever had to winning a national title? If you just go by seeds, 16 seed in the first round, 8 seed in the second round, 12 seed in the Sweet 16, 11 seed in the Elite Eight, 4 seed in the Final Four, 3 seed in the national title game. Has anybody ever had it that easy? You don't play any other 1 or 2 seeds. You only play one other team that's a top 3 seed, and then Georgia Tech, who's a 4 seed. Like, the toughest team seed-wise they played to get to the Final Four was an 8.
I mean, I'd have to look up some...
I mean, I'm aware you'd have to look it up, but I think it's as far as title winners, I know, was it Michigan a few years ago had a really easy path to the title game. They didn't actually win, though. So
that's what counts.
Yes, so it's as far as teams to actually win it, it's got to be one of the easier paths. But if you actually look through that whole bracket in 1990... it was incredibly dumb. Like, these are the seed matchups for the Elite Eight. In one region, you got the 1 versus the 3, right? That's pretty normal. The 3 seed upset the 1, but that's fairly normal, not crazy. But the other 3 regions, these were the matchups in the Elite Eight. UNLV was a 1 versus an 11. The other region was a 4 versus a 6. And then the last region was also a 4 versus a 10.
So they weren't, was this computer seeding?
Or I don't
was this,
know. I was going to say the selection committee did a terrible job. Like, this is not even close to being a good job by the selection committee. You've got 2 1 seeds and then 2 double digit seeds in the Elite Eight. We're not talking about the Sweet 16. You got to win 3 games to get the Elite Eight. This is like, what did Loyola Chicago, what did they do? They beat Nevada, who was a 7, to get to the Elite Eight. And then was it Kansas State that was an 8 or a 9 to get to the Final Four? So Loyola Chicago had a pretty stupid run to the Final Four as well. So you still have it every now and then. But, like, what is that going on there?
Again, maybe we should let a computer.
Probably. It'd be much better. Much better. Stacey Augman, though. That was, like, they only scored 69 points in the game. But Stacey Augman in transition. Oh, I think he had 20 points. And I think all of them were in transition. Either that or free throws for Stacey Augman. Like, he was fantastic in that game. dunked on somebody, just threw his knee into a guy's face while he dunked on him. Oh, it was great. Like, that was like the first game against Ohio State, kind of boring. That game, granted, not high scoring, but there were a lot of moments, mainly Stacey Augmenter was like, oh, this is why people love this team.
And I'd be a dumbass if I didn't or wasn't aware of that information.